Ladies and gentlemen, you're welcome back to your number one podcast in the world, Music History, Music Importance, and How the Dots Connect. This is your best bet to connect the old generation of music to what we have now and anticipate for the future. We're always excited to bring you this podcast, the Sample Access Podcast. My name is Goyega Nelson, is on the other side, and we have, of course, something special prepared today. What do we have? I don't know where to begin. The last time around, it was J.O. Araba, Adekunle Gold, and the other side was, I think, Wizkid. Was it Wiz? Okay, it was Asake Ajagba.
Yeah, and S.A.B.
And S.A.B., yes. So that was the last episode, and this one, we're trying to look at something about...
the U.S.
Essentially, we want to do a recap of that era. The pioneers of the sound called post-disco and jivey, the era from 1979 pushing forwards, and some of the that led that era. Nelson would do like a proper intro into our conversation today, but like you would know, I'm always excited that at least, you know, every time we have a new episode, it's exciting to learn about music, which I learned recently is the most important or relatable art form. I don't know if people agree on that, but yes,
I believe so. So yeah, Nelson right here, the main man, the metrics season guy. We're about to get into it. So today we would be talking about a great year in music, but even though we're going to be talking about the year 1983, we'd like to talk about everything that led to that point. And like Boyega said, talk about the UK pop scene, the US scene, and post-disco scene all around the same time. But there's no good way to start this without starting what we can say birthed the entire genre that is post-disco. So I'm going to go all the way back to Thursday, July 12, 1979 at Comiskey Park in Chicago, Illinois. Now, that game was supposed to be a game between Chicago White Sox against Detroit Tigers, and the game ended at some point. And after that, an event transpired or occurred, or an event happened right in front of everybody, and everybody knows that night as the disco demolition night. So prior to the time, talking about like in the 60s and all of that, when disco came into play, a lot of musicians actually tilted from what they were doing before to go to disco. And the reason why they did that was because disco was popping. It was the sound people listened to in the clubs. It was danceable. It was expressive. And just because of that, a lot of people felt that, that was the right form of music. And like what you guys said, it was an art form that was just beautiful. It made perfect sense. People could wear big shoes, they could wear tight trousers, and then have what we used to call, is it bootleg, or what do we used to call that? But I don't know whether I can remember the name of that trouser that people used to wear.
I think I remember bootcut.
Bootcut, yeah, that's what I was trying to remember. Where your bootcut jeans?
We had an era, a renaissance of bootcut, fashion.
That happened in 2005 to 2009-ish.
Yes, the ladies and the men too.
Yeah, they wore that again for a couple of times. I think immediately after, we got fully into the early 2000s, people kind of wore it again, starting from the white folks, and then the black folks picked it up again, and it became really nice. So, trying to just paint a picture of what that kind of time looked like, we had wonderful artists or groups like Saturday Night Fever. We had people like Chic holding down the scene, and Village People as well, that were the faces or face of disco. Village People, in the sense that we use them as one, even though they were a group, as a face of disco. They had a representation. And one thing that was kind of synonymous with all of these groups is the fact that they were all very expressive. If you think about all the songs that came out from the disco era, you had the men dressing how they want to dress, more or less like what we would see nowadays with a lot of people and how they, you know, express themselves with their dressing, and everything is all bling and it's beautiful and people are singing high notes. It was a time to be very, very expressive. But people got really angry and all of that. And they sort of thought that it was a way to promote cultures that we have gone past all of that. But at the time, it was thought that it was the homophobia kind of music, and a lot of people hated that. And that, you know, a lot of people thought it was a racist kind of music, they thought it was an expression of, you know, homophobia and racism. And this is me talking about the destruction of the disco. Now, all of this I'm saying right now is because we're about to get into something, a genre that was birthed from all the things that happened in this time. So, disco was big because of the nightclubs and the dance music, and a lot of African-American, Latin-American, and people at the time that were referred to as the gays, you know, at the time we had just, you know, probably the gays and lesbians, not like we have now, where it's more refined and well put together. The gay culture then, they were the ones that were listening to it, and they made it become mainstream. So it became a problem. And a lot of people at the time that had a lot of homophobia and racism in them came around, and they broke all sorts of vinyl records to represent the end of disco. And because of this, I can say, I don't want to use the word paradigm shift, but I feel like that's very important as well. There was some sort of shift that happened, and everybody kind of tilted away from playing disco music because nobody wanted to be canceled, even though the word canceled was not used at the time, but nobody wanted to be in the black book of people or black book of listeners. So they avoided the genre altogether. And at the time as well, you can also remember that we had a couple of genres around. You know, there was pop, there was psychedelic rock, there was hard metal. All of this were already working at the time. And of course, the big R&B that a lot of people loved, and blues, and all sort of genres. So that one was the only one that was actually targeted. The good thing about it is that regardless of all the things that happened on that fateful day, there were no deaths recorded. Maybe about 0 to 30 people were injured, but no deaths were recorded. And all of that brought us into a new mix, which is post-disco. Hold tight.
Post-disco, right? This is 1979 timestamp. Is it forward? 79, right?
Yeah, 1979, they're moving forward.
Okay, so who were the leading names or the turning point figures, so to speak?
Yeah.
Who were the characters? What I believe Motown Records was out, and
I'll talk about them now.
Who were the pioneers who led the sound?
Yeah, so for the pioneers that led the sound, I think we have to also start with the fact that, you know, as soon as the whole madness ended and they had to switch, and it took a while before it picked on a life of its own. So of course you understand that it will not just happen immediately. This happened in July. Radio had to reset, and then, you know, studios and record labels had to rewrite their goals and their approach for the year. And a lot of people had already had records that were close to disco, but not far, close to disco and far from it at the same time. I'll explain. It sounded like disco music, but there was a lot of other kind of genres embedded into it. So it wasn't like Les Freak, or it wasn't like Everybody Dance, or it wasn't like Saturday Night Fever. I just kind of felt like there was more R&B, there was more electronic, there was more soul in all of those music, and the disco was probably just the underlying part of the beat and underlying part of the music. And so all of these songs that came out after July 79 and were accepted by the public were sort of looked at as the pioneers of post-disco. And even though I feel like I have my idea of people that I feel like should be the head or the guys that actually made a genre, people like Michael Jackson that released an album in 1979, like Off the Wall. Off the Wall, even though Off the Wall had some songs that a lot of people would say sounds like, sounds like disco. But when you realize that Off the Wall was released in August 10th, 1979, which was probably less than a month, or probably less than 15 days after the disco demolition, a lot of people just kind of feel like, oh yeah, that's the first thing we had after the whole man. I think it was more of a psychological thing. So nobody would talk about these people are the pioneers, but they would believe that because of these guys released songs after all of this madness, and the songs didn't sound as disco-like as you would expect it to be, they were given that push as the pioneers of the music. Example of these guys, you know, for example, 1981, we had people like Fantastic Voyage that was released by, can you remind me Fantastic Voyage? Fantastic.
Not Cool and the Gang.
Nah.
The Commodore.
My God.
That's not a problem. We should remember that now.
Lakeside.
Lakeside,
yeah. So people like Lakeside that had Fantastic Voyage on, it kind of felt like they were the pioneers of the music. But when you go deeper into the years, you see a lot of people that actually did a whole lot of work of making the sound unique and putting more life into it. For example, people like Unlimited Touch, D-Train, one name comes to mind, Kashif. All of these guys, they had like, they were like the traditional post-disco sound. They were the first original, like, you know,
yeah,
fresh coats in terms of the genre itself. Like, they are the perfect representation of the genre. You understand what I'm saying? Because most of their song had everything in it. Sing funk, electro funk, you know, dub music, P-funk, soul, R&B. They mixed it all together. Techno music, it was all in the same. They all mixed all of that inside one particular genre and made the songs. You know, songs like I Just Love Yourself by Kashif, Unlimited Touch had a couple of songs as well, D-Train had a couple of songs, and all of that just made it beautiful. And even though the musical elements were things that a lot of people thought that, you know, made it different, there are a couple of groups that we can actually talk about that took it from one level to another. And Greg, thank you very much for also talking about some of the record labels, because like I was saying earlier, some record labels took their time to reinvent. And some of them are DeGriffy, you know, and Leon Silvers III with Solar Records. I'm sure you know Solar Records because I talk about them all the time.
Yes.
Lakeside were part of Solar Records at some point as well. Now, Capitol Records. Capitol Records had BB and Q Band. I don't know whether you know the song, Your Wish Is My Command, You're My Genie. Now, that song,
I think I heard it.
Yeah, you've probably heard it before. I used to use it to start the show when I did A Blast from the Past. But then, BB and Q Band.
Your wish is my.
It's my command. My genie. Yeah.
You know the song.
I'm a bad singer. I'm sorry. I wish I could do better. And then we also had like people like Change. I know you know Change as well, because I'm sure we've spoken about Change a lot right here.
Yeah.
So Change at some point had Luther Vandross, at some point had Jocelyn Brown, had a lot of names. Village People, like I said. Now, this is where it gets more interesting. Remember when I was talking about the first part of this podcast, probably the introduction part of this podcast, I said there was a group that was viewed as the face of disco. The beautiful thing is that Village People, even though they were not as big, after they left, after we left the disco era, they are still looked at as the first guys that redid their music and were accepted immediately. Now, let me put this in context for you. Most of the groups, apart from the top groups, like the Kool & the Gangs, the Cameos, the Cashmere, which is they don't do disco as much. I'm talking about guys that took their time to do albums or songs in the genre. So all of these guys, and these are the top guys I'm calling right here. So all of these guys, they did Kool & the Gang. I don't know why I was forgetting Kool & the Gang. All of these guys did disco, right? And they had hits. They had big songs. But the moment the disco demolition thing happened, they came back and they dropped albums that were even way better than the disco albums they dropped. Now, Chic, for example, Chic did not remain the same because Chic was known as the disco band. So even though they tried several things, they didn't really get as much. Village People is one of them. Now, Village People, even though they didn't have a lot, or even though they didn't have as much credit or as much cred or as much, you know, hype as they did when they were doing disco, they are still looked at as the first guys that pushed the envelope and made post disco a thing. And then we also have people like Richie Family. And I basically think everybody that was on Solar Records had a great time doing post disco because they were enjoying themselves at the time. And Kool & the Gang, you cannot look away from them. Those guys probably did it all. And because of they adopted, you know, the light pop part of post disco, they were already a pop band. And in 79, JT Taylor already joined them. They already switched up their way of music. Even before disco demolition happened, they had already started switching off from disco. They felt like they had to evolve to something else. And they got it on. And all of these guys are like big guys. And then when you think about post disco and you think about one of the maniacs in post disco, you call the name Rick James. Super Freak. When you think about the song Super Freak, that's one of those songs. Now, great guy, you might not know what Super Freak is, but when I make this sound, you probably know what it is. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. Do you remember where that's from?
It's hard to remember because...
Because it was redone in the 90s. It was sampled again in the 90s. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. Can't touch this.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
MC Hammer. But it's also dun, 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 dun. Dun, dun. Dun dun, then it goes Super Freak, Super Freak, Super Freaky. She's a very dirty girl. It's such a great song. Rick James had it on lockdown. And of course, you think about Tina Marie, but I don't want to talk too much right now. So I'm going to allow Wega to probably tell us a little some of the artists that had it going on, had it going good at the time. And then I'll come back in again and talk about all the people that had it good in 1983.
So there is this group from 1967. That was when they first met. In fact, I didn't know so much about them until this episode. Hall and Oates, funny name, but they did rock, and then they slid into other genres, particularly this one, disco and jivey music. Hall and Oates from Philadelphia in America. Just a little bit about them. They are considered one of the most successful duos of all time. One account says in rock history, another account says of all time, ahead of the Carpenters, the Everly Brothers, and Simon and Garfunkel. Now, let's look at the formation and the sound they made. I can see about 18 to 20 albums or more that they are known for. I'll try and get to that later, and I would also want you to speak to the importance of a group like this after I have done a breakdown. In 1967, these guys happened to be around Pottstown, Pennsylvania. There is Dario Franklin Hall and John William Oates. It happened that they were already leading their, each of them was heading their own musical group. Hall was with the Temptones, and Oates was with the Masters. They were doing music separately, and something brought them together because one of the reasons was that they were attending Temple University together in Pennsylvania, I think Philadelphia, and then they started moving together, stayed together in some apartments, and then they came together as a group. That's actually funny because how could they just work together when they already could build solo careers with their bands already? But Destiny brought them together, and they have been performing since 1967, 68, up till recently, up till about a few years ago. They were still performing, 2017 leading into 2019 and all that. They signed to Atlantic Records around that time before 1972, and then they continued to make music. Some of the genres that they are known for, there's folk, there's rock, there's soul, and indeed, there's a wide range. They have rock and roll, soul music, rhythm and blues, but like we said, some disco, dance, rock was also embedded in their music. So I'd like to know, how interactive was the genre, the disco, the post-disco genre? Because we saw how it led into hip-hop at some point as well, with the Run DMC, Public Enemy, and some of those groups. How well did post-disco interact with other genres, specifically in the case of Hall and Oates, who were rock musicians and then merged into post-disco? Do you have any accounts as to interactions with and blending into other genres? And I'd like you to also lead the conversation about Prince, so we can come back to that, among other things that you want to add.
Oh, okay. All right. So one of the things that actually happened, let me first start off with your very first question about how interactive it was, talking about the genre. Truth be told, it wasn't so interactive. It was close-knitted. It was a close-knitted genre. And I think that is why the genre did not last as long as the other genres. It was because only a few could do it, and a few could do it well. Now, the others that tried, and the others that wanted to put in so much effort, they just didn't get it done. For example, I wouldn't call Hall & Oates, big ups to them, yeah, they did a couple of post-disco songs, but I wouldn't call them post-disco singers. They were musicians in their own right, and they had wonderful stuff. Yeah, probably the most decorated group of the 80s. The only group that comes after is Kool & the Gang, and after that, Earth, Wind & Fire. So I wouldn't really put them in that box, but what I would say that it wasn't interactive enough. And I feel like if they had measures, maybe, or some sort of music, like the way we have a rap and R&B, if we had post-disco and some rappers coming into play. I mean, it was so wild that, this is crazy, but it's the truth. Post-disco rappers at the time, post-disco singers at the time would rather break down rap in their music than do it with the help of a rapper. Although, yes, it wasn't a thing at the time, but, you know, if you listen to songs like Bernard Wright, Who Do You Love? Now, although that song was redone again by LL Cool J on the song Lounging, which was really good and became a hit. Bernard Wright decided to do some sort of, not rap, but, you know, some sort of spoken word there, which could have been done by somebody else, or, you know, maybe emerged with another artist. It would have been more exciting, but he didn't do that. And the music came out great, but I think that that's one of the things that actually held it down. Now, and also, I just feel like I have to talk about the golden age of post-disco, because, like I said, it was a very short time. Started in 1979, probably lasted to like 1986, 1987. And this was because immediately after post-disco, we had New Jack Swing, which I've spoken about a lot. We probably have one simple, I don't know whether we had an episode where we talk about New Jack Swing.
I wouldn't be able to remember now, but I think we must have one or two. We have done so much. So whether it's, okay, New Jack Swing is definitely not this guy from 1993. What's his name? Tevin Campbell? That's not New Jack Swing.
No, that's not. I don't be as beautiful as it could be.
Yes. Let me take time and just do a search and see what we did in that line. New Jack Swing is, okay, what about this man that Foxy Brown sampled?
Oh, yeah, that's a great guy. Eugene Wilde. That's That's not New Jack Swing, but it's some beautiful R&B.
Yes.
Oh, I'm going to listen to that song just because.
Hardaway?
Thank you for reminding me.
Anything on Hardaway? People would be shocked.
Hardaway was EDM, so nah.
Yeah, so I think I should just stop trying. People would be.
It's all good.
I refused to learn. Grady Harrell.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's Belinda, hey Belinda.
Yeah, we have a good discography.
Yeah. That's a very good one. But let me continue quickly and talk about the Pioneers. And I feel like this is a good place to bring Prince into play. But before I talk about Prince, so that Guega will give us enough time to talk about, or be right here to talk about Prince. And the beat goes on. The Whispers, that was released in 1979. To me, a lot of people are going to come for me for this. Okay, I shouldn't say that, but I feel like, you know, it's going to be like one of those things where people would want to say, oh yeah, Nelson, what you have said is very wrong. But I think, And the Beat Goes On is the first song that should be officially put down as the first post-disco song. Released in 1979, went number one in the US dance chart, number one in the US R&B chart, number 19 in the pop chart, number two in the UK, Solar Records. Like I said before, Leon Silvers III, Dick Griffey, those guys were the guys that actually started what we know now as post-disco. They refined it, they made it great, and the Beat Goes On, that was released in 1979, is probably their starting song. Celebration in 1980, that's a no-brainer, probably one of the biggest post-disco songs of all time. And then we had Let's Groove, that was released by Earth, Wind & Fire in 1981. The 1981 as well, even though it is not talked about a lot, I like to always put in Lakeside's Fantastic Voyage. I think it's an amazing song. I think it's beautiful. Everybody by Madonna in 1982. Forget Me Not. Now, Forget Me Not, it's a jam forever. Elektra Records, Patrice Russian, amazing stuff. And then in Deep, Last Night the DJ Saved My Life. That's a beautiful song as well. And then one of the songs I love so much from the year 1983, Holiday. And of course, we know what happened in 1983. Michael Jackson was still enjoying the success of Thriller that was released in 1982. So you can as well put most of those songs in the post-disco vibe. I think Billie Jean was post-disco. PYT was post-disco. Human Nature, probably not post-disco, but most of the songs off Thriller were done in the post-disco format because of it was the vibe at the time. And now I'll quickly go back to Prince. I would come back to talk about some of the songs that just did it for me as, you know, post-disco songs that were beautiful. But we'll talk about Prince. Now, Prince, I Want to Be Your Lover. I want to be your lover. I don't know how to sing. I know it's terrible, but I'm going to try. Prince was the Prince of the 80s. Prince Rogers Nelson, yeah. His last name is Nelson. Prince Rogers Nelson, that passed away in 2016. American singer, wonderful artist, that was good in every single thing. I think that guy had a knack for everything. Funk, R&B, new wave, soul, synth-pop, pop, jazz, and blues, hip-hop at some point. But you see, when post-disco came out, he released the song, I Wanna Be Your Lover, that was so huge. And it kind of set a tone. So that's why I always say this, that even though And The Beat Goes On, to me, is the first song that should be referred to as post-disco, the greats and the researchers and the music, what's the word? Is it music connoisseur? Is that what I'm going to say, Guega? The guys that put, you know, all this culture together would say, I Want to Be Your Lover was the first one. And I think that's why Prince is so important to the culture.
Yes, I'll try to look at his discography, which is a lot. First of all, he is considered one of the greatest musicians of all time. And I think that's it goes without saying, because the debate between him and Michael Jackson is actually something to take note of. So it's a no-brainer when records say that he's regarded as one of the greatest musicians of all time, of his generation, not of all time, I beg your pardon. He's ranked number 27 on the list of 100 greatest artists, and all those legacy mentions would go on and on. Now, I wanted to know what the mystery behind an artist like Prince. His performances had a certain aura. His image, sometimes scary, sometimes has like a mystical feeling, a mystical posture to it. He's not the ordinary person, so to speak. So there's something about him. And one more thing that I noticed later is that he had this issue with his label, or maybe with the industry in general. He was outspoken about artists being able to appreciate their independence and work towards that, such that some of his albums were released independently, and he tried to, you know, manage his situation such that, label issues or not, he would be independent and create a legacy still. So I think I appreciate the fact that upon whatever happened, he was able, his name is still here in a way that he is recognized for his elite artistry as a musician, as a performer, and all the albums that he has done, and his legacy as an artist activist, if there's something like that. Let me take a look at his discography, some of the albums that, and then again, he was an artist of different eras. Here I'm looking at 1978 all the way down to 2015, and even after his death, posthumous albums were released. So from 1978, a different era, in the 90s, 1992 to 99, many albums, we're talking up to 10 albums, he was still out there. And then you could also see the influence he had on other artists, and also the sound of hip-hop. I'll talk about that later, but album titled For You, 1978, 1980, Dirty Mind, 81, Controversy. I'll jump to 1990, Graffiti Bridge, Diamonds and Pearls in 1991, Love Symbol album, 1992, The Black Album, 1994, which again would speak to Jay-Z. I really can't say if Jay-Z peaked from that, but Hove also has an album called The Black Album. The Gold Experience, 95, and then it goes on and on. By 2004, we have Musicology, Chocolate Invasion, The Slaughterhouse, Planet Earth in 2007, and it goes on and on. So I think generally we just have to appreciate the person and the mystery behind the artist by the name Prince, George Nelson. Now, let's talk about, I don't know if you have mentioned it, but his genres. He has been inducted posthumously, or I think even while he was alive, into many halls of fame, rock and roll in particular, and then rhythm and blues. But what would be his most important genre, Prince Rogers Nelson? I'm talking about the artist.
Yeah, I think his most important genre is probably, when you think about Prince, a lot of things comes to mind, right? Like I said, he was that guy, he was doing every single thing. So he was the popping guy. And let me first address the mystery before I come around and tell you about the genre I think he probably should be, you know, known for. Prince had this vibrant energy that is inexplicable. Apart from the fact that he's a great musician in the sense that his voice is amazing, he could dance, he could hold down a crowd. When I mean a crowd, I'm talking about thousands of people. He could sing his heart off, and he was just completely talented. A lot of people look at him and say, oh my, such a multi-instrumentalist, could sing in falsetto. And at the time, falsetto was amazing. And also, he had this androgynous persona. That's what I think Vega was trying to explain before. Sometimes he looked very normal. Sometimes he looked like he was on the edge. Sometimes he looked like he was too flamboyant. But that was him. That's why people loved him. He connected to the guys. to the girls and every other person. I feel like he was like, I think Prince, and yeah, I know when I say this, it might sound like I'm trying to be crazy or something, but I think Prince is an embodiment of what the 80s was like. Well, do you understand what I'm saying? I'm talking about the mixed cultures, because it was during the 80s we had people like, you know, Boy George of Culture Club. Kama Chameleon. And then we had Camille. The guys from Camille, like Larry Blackmon, they had a persona. It was in the same 80s we had people like Luther Vandross. It was the same 80s we had people like Verdun White. It was the same 80s we had people like Michael Jackson. And all of these guys, they were just, it just felt like, I don't know, it's crazy, but it felt like Prince just represented every single one of them. And it's crazy to think about it, that Prince only came into music in 1975. So Michael Jackson had already been around at least 9 years before, or 8 years before. So Michael Jackson and Prince kind of had this, I wouldn't say it's a match, but like a healthy competition for who influenced people the most. I don't know if you get what I'm talking about. Like, yeah. Who influenced people the most? Like, is it Michael or Prince? But Prince had an amazing vocal. It was different. But I kind of feel like, even to today, you can still, it's a conversation that can be had. A lot of artists will tell you the length, their ways from Prince, white artists, black artists. And a lot of people will tell you they are better musicians, or they were better musicians those years because of Michael Jackson. So, and this is one of the good things about, you know, Prince as well, is the fact that he didn't put himself in a box. Prince was always working on one thing or the other. So putting him in one genre might be seen as insulting.
Oh, not fair. Because he did
not fair. Because think about Purple Rain. Now, when you hear Purple Rain, you think about a kind of sound, like it's electro, it's R&B, it's synth pop, it's pop all put together in one, and then there's a lot of talking underneath. It was unconventional. I mean, you can call it new wave, but people loved him. And then the Prince album in 1979 was huge. Dirty Mind in 1980, Controversy in 1981, and like you already said yourself, a lot of artists after the time would still say Prince was one that actually gave me the edge to say I could do this. You understand how I could be this. And it was also referred to as the love symbol. I remember there was one, you know, comedy short that I watched at some point, and one guy said Prince was so cool, guys had a crush on him, and they were not like that, or they were not gay. Does that make any sense though? That's how cool he was to people. Like I said, guys liked him so much, they had a crush on him and they were not gay.
There's a famous video of him and Beyonce performing, right?
Yeah.
You haven't seen that?
I have seen it. He was playing the guitar most of the time.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he was.
Yeah, so he wasn't playing it, so he was playing the guitar most of the time.
Some of those moments are also very precious, because most of the greats, if you get a chance to work with some of the greats, some of them are still alive, but you never really appreciate them until they leave. What's this woman's name? Tina Turner. She passed away a few months ago, and it was, I liked how they celebrated her because of her legacy and the work she did. But sometimes you just feel like, so people really have to go, and when they go, it's done. So when they're alive, collaborations, give them their flowers and all that. Remember Aretha Franklin 2-3 years ago. So we are seeing a generation really, really leaving. Some of them have left already. It's only a few of them left. And so I think it's impressive. It's good to give them the flowers while they are here. Now, I think that's a good place to segue or to drift out of post-disco and jive and see the other side in the UK briefly. Before we talk about other adjoining topics and then we wrap this up, what's up in the UK, pop music at the time, and, you know, did we have cross-country interactions as much as we do today?
Well, I think we have said this times without number. If we are looking for anybody that got a good good push in or how do I put this? Let me put it this way. The people that benefited the most from the 80s has to be the UK scene. Apart from the fact that there was stuff like MTV happening at a time where MTV started the TV industry and it was booming. You think about a lot of groups that had good times. Five Star. I mean, I don't know whether you know this, but Billy Ocean is actually from the UK. So many of those artists that had a good time in America. Let me quickly go through maybe a couple of the artists that were leading the line in 1983. Now, I'm going to use 1983 actually in question. Gwega, do you know the number one song at the end of the year in the Billboard in US in 1983?
Was that the same Christmas song? No.
No.
I'm messing
it was Every Breath You Take. Guess by who?
The Police. Right?
Yeah. Police is a UK band. And they were top tier. They were literally number one on the Billboard charts. That was special because it hadn't happened. I mean, they were close, but that year kind of like opened it up to them that, oh yeah, we could actually do all the way and get here. Now, I'm going to make it more interesting to tell you why I used to always say, I feel like most of the time, these guys kind of took like the UK scene took hold of that time. Number 10 song in the year in 1983 is Sweet Dreams. Sweet Dreams by who? Eurythmics. You go all the way to, and you think about what happened also. David Bowie, biggest year, was with Post Disco, Let's Dance. And also, you go crazy again. A lot of groups from that time took their power and like they basically had a good time because of the fact that there was a good time for them to come into the music scene. And guess what? It just wasn't in the UK. All the way in Australia, Men at Work got into the Billboard charts also with Down Under in 1983. And this happened over the years from 1983 to probably 1990s. And that was like the opening. And one artist that, oh my God, I'm so happy I did not forget him because I would have been really pain. Rick Astley with Never Gonna Give You Up, Never Gonna Want You Down. That's Rick Astley. Yeah, that's him. At the time as well. And a lot of artists that I could have actually called as well. Maybe let me call a couple of names that I can remember. Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Around was a big one too in the UK and in the US in 1985. Never Gonna Give You Up in 1987. Panorama and Venice in 1986, which is probably like the last year that we would give to like post-disco. Although 1987, the early parts was good enough. But Five Star and a lot of artists, I cannot remember most of them right now, Total Contrast. Total Contrast. That had Richard Achempong and I forgot the name of the other guy. Total Contrast, give me a second. I'm trying to remember the name of that group. Total Group. Wait, have we spoken about Total the Group before?
I don't think so.
Yeah, Total Contrast. Why did they stress me? Yeah, I know it's how they talk now. Sorry, let me get back to it. Hmm. Yeah, so Total Contrast also in the 80s as well. They got a couple of albums in. Hit and Run is a big jam from 1985. And they also released something in 1987. The group had two names actually, Robin Achampong and Delroy Murray. So those two guys from the UK as well. So there are many names that you can call from the UK. I mean, it's like sometimes you need to remind a lot of people that Elton John is a Brit as well. You think about it. And also, there are so many names. Well, you got so many names that I know that I wouldn't be able to call all of them for sure because how many would I be able to remember? But the ones that can come to my mind right now, you think about them. But I can tell you for sure that if you do a quick sweep of all the top guys in the 1980s that benefited from not just having their own genre, but because of post-disco was happening in 79 to 85, a lot of people had that opportunity to come in to the scene.
Let's bring this home a little bit, and this already feels like an interview, but pardon me, we're trying to wrap this up soonest. MTV Base coming on the scene, how does that connect to this story, one? And secondly, let's bring it down to Nigeria. What was happening in Nigeria, and how did that era in America and around the world, post-disco driving music, how did that connect to us as Nigerians? Were we consuming enough from them, or were we missing sound?
Yeah, so I think starting off with how the post-disco do when it got in here, I kind of think that it's always good to point out the fact that MTV Base had a huge influence, and I think I already said that, in the music, because the videos that were brought in made post-disco bigger than it was. I think the fact that post-disco even had a good run was because of the music videos. For example, Billie Jean, that was released in 1983, you know, alongside the videos on MTV. And also, I think I've said this quite a number of times, that anybody that listens to the podcast already knows that I've said this numerous times, that most of the videos that were played on MTV in the early days were from the UK. And this was the reason why, because the UK used to, the UK artists, it was part of their deals to make videos for their songs. But it wasn't a deal for US artists, because they wanted, US artists were good with selling just the vinyl records. But in UK, one of the ways to put yourself out there is to make a music video, right? So it was the culture of the UK people. And that's how they connected, and that's how the music in the UK meshed perfectly well with the music in the US. Now, bringing it out home to Nigeria, we had just the best sounds got here. But for the musicians that were here, they were listening to every single thing. And that's why a lot of people would say somebody like Alex O sounds a whole lot like Bernard Wright, or sounds a whole lot like Bobby Brown, or sounds a whole lot like, you know, or even Bobby Brown might be seen as unfair, because Alex O was probably popping even before Bobby Brown became a thing.
I said it was about that life.
Yeah, it was about that life too as well. So when you think about people like Chris Okotie too. So I think the musicians right here, what they did was, the musicians right here served as a medium. So instead of the song, of course, the people that were going to the clubs at the time knew the Earth, Wind & Fire, knew Hall & Oates, knew all the artists, knew Elton John. But the regular folks that would stay at home and not party and listen to a lot of music were fed that music in a different light. So someone like Obi Onyeha would have listened to Donna Summer, Gladys Knight, all of these ladies, Gwen Guthrie, God bless her soul, Jocelyn Brown. And then she would come up and make another song. Now, this would be her own song, Nigerian song, but indirectly you are listening to all these other artists as well. No doubt the creativity of Obi Onyeha and the beautiful sounds that she produced. But you get what I'm saying? That was the sound. So it was like a connect. When you hear songs like, "We just want to enjoy your life," you think about other songs from the time as well. You think about songs from the 80s. You think about her sounding like Gwen Guthrie, you know, or The Power, or something like Tina Ndiwe, God bless her soul as well, Black on Black. Asiko Lolaye. Yeah. You just knew that it was coming from sounds like Cedar Garrett, you know, that was sounding at the time, singing songs like "Welcome to the Groove of the." Wait, did I know how to sing?
Stop trying.
I know how to sing?
I think we should just try to rein this home now. In the grand scheme of things, post-disco jive was a very important era in music, as it wasn't just a form of entertainment and a pure art form, a pure energetic and vibrant art form. It also inspired the sounds that came after it. And of course, it remains history of the people, the artists who did their best to push out that genre. And I'm sure was tons and tons of music. A lot of the artists that we, you know, that did the work at the time, we may not mention them now, but the ecosystem is like, music is a necessity. The job has to be done. So it's not even about the artist sometimes, it's about the art form and everybody playing their part. Anything else we're missing out on before we go?
Oh, I think if our synopsis is good, I feel like maybe we can stop here and probably preserve some music for next time, or preserve some talk for next time, because of course I feel like this talk is not done and there's going to be more that will surround it. There's so many artists to talk about. I mean, so many. Now that I've said something about Five Star, I just kind of feel like we have to talk about them. The quintet of cousins. They were cousins and they made beautiful music. Yeah. All falls, I'm sure anybody that was popping in terms of listening to a lot of music at the time, some of our fathers right now, when they hear All Falls Down, my father still busts a move when he hears All Falls Down. Like, my father would try to do the dance steps from the song. So it was a beautiful time for them. So we'll talk about some, you know, there were some underground artists that, and that's the kind of power that Lakeside has. Lakeside were big in the 70s, not so big in the 80s, but they were so good that they released one song and people would consume for two reasons. They knew these guys were good, and because they were already the guys to them. I don't know if that makes any sense. So many groups that I feel like, even the world at large, we kind of don't talk about them, like Total Contrast, or even the ones that we think are up there, like High Five. Everybody just ignores High Five. But High Five played such a major role in changing the idea of music.
Yeah.
At the time when High Five was making songs, people like Tony Thompson were not allowed to lead a group. That's why people like Ralph Tresvant was not allowed to lead the group at the time. There had to be, you know, that's why I say music is so much in depth. There's so many things in depth. If you wanted to lead a music group at the time, you need to have charisma. Even like till today, you need to have charisma. You need to be bold. You need to be sellable. You can't just be, you have to have the personality. But for Tony Thompson, apart from being a very fine boy at the time, he wasn't that guy, you know. He wasn't you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, this has been an expository one. It feels academic because it's not our regular episode. We just had to take it a step away from the regular and just examine that genre, post-disco and jive, and some of the players in that space. Of course, this is not the first time we'll do like a special focus on a genre. We will do more, but in the past we have attempted to express some genres like high life. We have done something on hip-hop as mixtapes, and in other ways we have done something on, you know, Fuji the Sound. Many more than once we have done something on Fuji. So it continues. In fact, rock music with I think the name of a band, Aerosmith. So it goes on and on. Whenever there is need to look at some of these genres, it's part of our work to understand and implement the music space as per genre. Different genres that are available. Nelson, that's our wrap. No production credits for today, right?
Yeah, definitely no production credits. Go and listen to Post Disco. Go on YouTube, go on Spotify and type Post Disco.
And enjoy yourself. So that's about it. We got there signing out.
Nelson Winnie, the main man, the metrics, the season guy sounding out. We out. The Sample Access, administered by Boyega
Nelson. Yeah, I'm trying. You're listening to the Sample Access Podcast.